I'm not going to do a huge introduction, except to say a few years ago I fell in love with the Baal Trumata Deshen, Rav Yisrael Yisrael. Who lived from 1390 to 1460 in Austria at the time, and had a unique ability to take conflicting legal values that were usually much bigger than a strict halachic category and navigate how to come to some sense of religiosity through them. He was unique in a lot of ways. He was mostly unique because most of the Achronim thought he wrote his own questions. It's a very unique book of Shaylot and Tshuvot where you almost get a sense as you're reading them, you sort of read them through like a book, that he had things that he wanted to say about previous codes and what was happening around him halachically, but he didn't want to write another code because by that point you already had the Rambam, the Rosh, the Tur, the Smog. I mean, there were enough authoritative codes out there. And by writing a sort of book of shooting, they became authoritative in a way that potentially other codes wouldn't have. So if you read the Beit Yosef, you'll see that Rav Karo often relies heavily on the Trumata Deshen, which is interesting because, of course, he's not Sephardic. And you'll see that the Ramah will add him in as well, significantly. And so he was an extremely influential posek. I also will say that his Tshuvot are short. I mean, there's a lot of background material that he assumes, but for the most part, they're two paragraphs long. He's able to pack in some kind of religious conflict. And so I think it's two of them. You'll see what they're dealing with, but they tie really well into Rabbi Erickson's Shiur from last night. And I have always maintained that a good posek lives with her intuition, that above all else, once you figure out how to master sources or learn them well enough, then basically what you're left with is, what do I feel based on these sources is the right decision in this moment? And most poskim know what the answer will be, like I think the Trumata Deshen did, before you start writing, and sometimes even before you start learning, hoping, praying that this, you'll be able to muster the sources to give an answer that you think best helps somebody grow in their religious life, or live in their religious life at the very least. These two, I think, because I think there's a certain amount of personal autonomy that many religious Jews like to claim doesn't exist within the system. And nothing, no religious system could exist without personal autonomy, any religious system, and certainly not halakha, because unless your tzitzit are being checked on a regular basis, we all are making decisions on our own at every point in the day, decisions to do and decisions to not do. And so the system can only provide so much. At a certain point, it has to provide ways in which people can get answers, and I think he does that here. So let's just jump in. We're going to look at two questions, and then we'll have a look at the Trumata Deshen answers. Question number one, She'ela. Mashano hagim rov b'nei adam apham mitakdikim b'maaseihem litaseit b'yom ha'shabbat l'achar yitziat b'nei ha'knesset. So there's a practice during his time where many of the scrupulously observant Jews would gather on Shabbat after they left shul. In L.A., the people Robertson neighborhood, that means they're playing sheish fish in the park. That's essentially what it is. He's not talking about Shabbat meals. He's talking about groups of people who are sitting down someplace. And they're talking with each other, but what they're talking about is not Torah. Exactly. They're talking about politics. And, you know, the 15th century Europe was essentially when the Ottoman Empire really started to take over. Constantinople falls. There's a lot going on in the 15th century, and so there's a lot to talk about, and lives are at stake, although Jews in Vienna had it actually pretty well compared to others. Yesh chashash isur b'davar alav. is there some kind of esort in this kind of gathering with this kind of speech? That's issue number one. Issue number two, or question number two.
Is this some a public offense of this sort in a specific category, or is he also talking about the new car you bought? The new car that you bought, etc. Like, is this category a specifically difficult one?
I think that he's creating a paradigm. I think he's beginning to create a paradigm, and that the situation that at least is in front of him, or that he wants to be in front of him, is that these are observant Jews who somehow seem to be outside of what the parameters of halacha are based on speech. So I do think he means to open the category up to all kinds of speech that isn't about Shabbat, that isn't about sort of, well, we'll see about what isn't about Shabbat or is about Shabbat, but that isn't explicitly about Torah in the way that we usually define Torah. But what's the halakhic category here that we're probably dealing with? There are two halakhic categories. All of his tshuvot generally pit two halakhic categories, one against the other. So here, there's a negative and a positive.
Dabur davar, negative.
Right? Dabur davar, which is the negative commandment of?
Talking about business dealings or something?
Talking about business dealings or other things in general that are not part of Shabbat. That law has the force of
Rabbinic put forward in the prophets.
It's basically somewhere in between the Shvut, Medivre, Sofrim category. But it's clearly a prohibition. And the other side? And so part of the question that we need to sort of discover, or we need to discover, is what is that obligation? And because both of these categories are about as subjective as you could possibly imagine. We're talking about what people feel and what people say. And that doesn't fit well into a strict legal system. Case number two. So you have to take his word for it. The Gaonim, based on passages from the Talmud, ruled, so created another Shvut-like prohibition that claims you can only extend the distance you can walk on Shabbat or Yantif if it's going to be for a mitzvah. So, for instance, I'm allowed to walk 2,000 amot outside of my city, and my Rav lives another 1,000 amot away, and I want to go visit my Rav and learn Torah on Yontif or on Shabbat. So I go out to that wherever the 2,000 is, the 2,000 amot boundary outside of the city, and I put down wine or a meal or something, and I essentially create another 2,000 amot. But the Gaonim said, you can only do this for a mitzvah because it's already a leniency. Creating the Eruv at all is already one step outside of sort of the Torah system. So here's what I think is a fascinating question. If a Jew has a garden or a park outside of the 2000, really wants to go there on Yontif, to just be outside, to be in the garden, in order to play around, in order to experience joy on Yontif, by means of this extra Eruv, because the piece of property that this person wants to go to is beyond. Chashiv k'hai gavna l'tvar mitzvah olav. Is this act a devar mitzvah, which is to say, what are the parameters of the mitzvah to be joyous on Chag? How far do they extend? Are they objective? Are they subjective? And this is why I love Tremont Depression. He sort of gets to the heart of religious life and realizes that oftentimes emotional religious life and subjective religious life is going to come in direct conflict with certain categories that want to restrict behavior. And obviously, he holds them both to be authoritative. So how do you navigate these two questions? Okay, let's flip one full page. I just wanted to see a couple of his source texts for the first Chuba before we go back and look at his words. As Mark, as you pointed out, that Isaiah 58 is the source for all of the Shvutim on Shabbat that deal with Uvdin Dechol. The things that we do on the weekday, we should not be doing on Shabbat. Im tashiv Shabbat raglecha, asot chafatzacha, v'yom kochi v'karata la-Shabbat oneg, v'kdosh adonai mechubad v'chibadato me'asot derachecha, so tzacha v'daber davar. If you keep your feet from breaking Shabbat and from pursuing your affairs on my holy day, if you call the Shabbat a delight, the Lord's holy day, honored, and if you honor it and go not your ways, nor look to your affairs, nor strike bargains. That's the verse. Az tanagal adonai v'hircha ticha al bamate aretz v'achli ticha nachalat Yaakov avicha ki pi adonai diber. Then you will find your joy in God. I will set you astride the heights of the earth and let you enjoy the heritage of your father Jacob. The mouth of God has spoken. So, here it is. There's this verse has Oneg on the one hand and all of the things that you shouldn't do on the other hand. And it seems like Oneg is directly related to what you're pulling yourself back from so you can experience that emotion. The problem with the verse, Midrash, well, I would say in terms of the Pshat, is it seems to be saying the same thing over and over again. To which the rabbis of the Gemara will respond. So here's the sugya from Masechet Shabbat, page 113a, that gets to the heart of this. V'chibadato me'asot derachecha, v'chibadato shelo yehe malbushcha shel Shabbat k'malbushcha shel chol. What does it mean to honor Shabbat? You should dress differently on Shabbat. And I, you know, will often say, David, you said this in your session yesterday, that to honor something doesn't necessarily mean to conform to a certain expectation. Honoring already is subjective according to person, according to context, and according to place. And so what I will say to people when they ask me what to wear on Shabbat is, wear something that when you look in the mirror, you feel good about yourself. Because that's the only way you'll be able to stand before God. There's always going to be some context. You're not going to walk into a shul, wearing a bikini. But something that you feel honors the moment. For some people, that's a suit. For me, it's Shabbat in shorts. Because I have nice pants. I want people to see my hands. Or dungarees. But in any case, clothes are an expression of how we honor certain situations and certain moments. V'kihat Rabbi Yochanan kare lamane michbanitai. So Rabbi Yochanan would say, my clothes honor. The clothes that I wear honor. Me'asot derachecha shelo yehe hilukacha shel Shabbat hilukacha shel chol. This one is trouble. I mean, hard to understand. What does it mean to not go your ways? According to this text, it means that you're walking on Shabbat should be different than you're walking during the day. Now, that can mean a thousand different things. And the rabbis had a hard time with this one. So, to go after the things that you desire, your desires are forbidden, but what God desires is permitted. And that's picking up on the fact that it's very personal. The later rabbis interpret this to mean at least Rashi thinks this is Mekhaven. This is, you shouldn't do business. But it's vote. That's got what God wants you to do, no problem.
Doesn't Mekhaven say how Asurim appear in Samir?
It does.
It's like Hitaneg, which is great because this is the Pasuk of Barakomi.
Yeah, it's probably a direct poetic midrash on this. And lastly, Daber Davar. Shelo yehe dibur chashel shabbat dibur chashel kol dibur asur dibur derhor mutar. That your speech on Shabbat shouldn't be like your speech during the week. This, of course, is the sort of proof text for the question. The original source says for the question that we've been asked. Speaking itself is forbidden. Thinking things, thank God, is permitted. the rabbis were the most pragmatic, I think, in terms of who we are today and who we ought to follow, and so they understood early on.
Here we move to everyone.
So look at Rashi at the bottom on this. So what Rashi is saying is transactional conversations, even if money isn't being exchanged, which of course the Sephardic tradition with Aliyot on Shabbat completely left aside. Now, interestingly, flip the page for a second. It's the Tosafot's opinion that the Truman Hadesha is going to pick up. He says, Rebbeinu Tam doesn't think this is a reasonable explanation for this particular passage in the verse. We already learned that you can't pursue your needs. That's actually talking about the kinds of conversations that are transactional on Shabbat. So Ela, Omer Rabbeinu Tam, Kita Amar Vayikra Rabba, Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai, Havale Ema, Sabda Vahave Mishnaye, Sage. So he actually learned it out, Rabbeinu Tam, from Vayikra Rabba, where Rabbi Shimon Ben Bar Yochai had a mother, apparently, who spoke a lot on Shabbat. Amar La Ema, Shat. She stopped talking. Mashma she'en kol kach l'daber b'shabbat k'mo b'chol. We learned from this story that we shouldn't really be talking on Shabbat to the extent that we do during the weekdays, which is to say, it isn't necessarily, according to the Tosafot, the type of speech that's already been decided. It's also the amount.
It's quantity, not quality.
V'Yerushalmi amrinan b'torah. And in Yerushalmi, there's a passage where you see the rabbis actually didn't even want to permit Sheilat Shalom on Shabbat because they thought those youths could be misused and not part and parcel of the day itself. Which is to say, and I think the religious message here is quite profound. We spend a lot of time during the week filling the world with words. Not just things, but with words. We use them constantly on Shabbat. At least according to this tradition, pull back. The only thing I think that the story is, always been a little bit bothersome to me. My guess is the real story in Vayikra Rabba that should have been transmitted is Rabbi Shimon and his Ima were hanging out a lot on Shabbat, and the kid would not shut up. And at a certain point, she said, Shimi, enough already, stop talking, and it's Shabbos. Please, some peace. But the rabbis just couldn't write that story down because of who he was. And so they wrote it down the opposite way, and he becomes the religious. I'm sort of making this up, but when I read this story, I'm sitting there thinking, come on.
He fried them with his eyes.
Right. Welcome. We are on. Alright, so I'm going to give brief context. The brief context is we're looking at two tshuvot of the Tshuvat HaDeshen, Rav Yisrael Yisraelin, who generally will pit halachic ideals and values and religious values one against the other. And so he asked two questions. One, for people who gather on Shabbat after davening and want to talk about current events, politics, is this within the boundaries of Oneg Shabbat, or does it cross over what we're looking at now, the boundaries of speech on Shabbat? So Oneg, a positive obligation, things we're not allowed to say, shvutim, something like that. In antiquity, apparently, people waited until they left shul to talk politics. The second question was, Rabbi, there's a park I want to go to on Yom Tov. I like to be in that park. I like to play with my kids there. I like to enjoy myself there. It's outside Tchum. Am I allowed to make an Eruv? An Eruv Tchumi? Am I allowed to use that in order just to go to that park on Yom Tov to experience the joy that I feel when I'm there? And of course, the question being, the Gaoni ruled based on a couple passages in the Talmud that you could only make an Eruv Tchumi
for Dvar Mitzvah. Does this count?
And so how I set this up is we're dealing with strict categories of law that are very functional and tangible and technical. On the one hand, they tend to be Isurim in our tradition, and on the other hand, emotional, subjective categories of law. Like things that I feel that nobody else may feel, can I use them in the system that's meant to sort of not necessarily coercively, but sometimes coercively control everybody. That's what's being pitted up here. So we just looked at the passage from the Masechet Shabbat on speech, and according to Rashi, not speaking like we do on the weekday on Shabbat is about Mekach Memtar and Cheshbonot. It's about business dealings and transactional. And according to the Tosafot, it's about the amount of speech. We're actually supposed to speak fewer words on Shabbat than we do during the rest of the week. All right, I'm really bad when it went with page numbers to remember the Pentagon. You think I'd learn this by now. I teach a class in rabbinical school called Teaching Rabbinic Texts, and I will mark papers if they don't have page numbers on it, and I never remember to do it. I'm great to know. So it's side one page. If you flip two full pages, the back side, there's half a page of text. We just looked at the Tosafot, where Rabbi Shimon and Yochai said to his mother, who used to talk a lot on Shabbat, please stop. I'm not going to do that again. Okay. Now, that's one piece of it. So now we know the prohibition. The prohibition, Daber Davar, from Rashi, from Yeshayahu, from Rashi is business transactional conversations. From the Tosafot, it's don't speak too much on Shabbat. And that falls somewhere in the category of Medivrei Sofrim and Shvut, but they're clear Isurim on Shabbat. They don't rise to the level of Diyoraita. On the other side of it, what the Truma Tadesha needs to understand for answering people about whether or not they can have conversations on Shabbat about politics, if they enjoy it, is what's the scope of Oneg? Is Oneg a mitzvah? And how defined is it? And so I gave you a couple texts here just so people could see what most people don't actually believe. I find that most people I teach Oneg Shabbat to think that it's so subjective that it can't really be the same kind of mitzvah that actually has trumping power over negative commandments at all. So if somebody says, but Rabbi, on Shabbat, I really enjoy doing that, I can't do it. Our first instinct, or am I allowed to do it? Usually the first instinct is to say, well, you enjoy it, but somebody else won't, so how can I make a psak for you? Then I have to make it for everybody, and now all of a sudden the system's going to fall into oblivion. Or, it's so subjective that the rabbis just meant you're supposed to enjoy Shabbat, so they created this Shabbat meal, the source of Oneg, which is really about relationships, why we light the candles on Shabbat initially. For one reason, and that's so people who are sitting across the table from one another could talk and look each other in the eye. That's what creates the space of delight. Because Oneg isn't, I'm having a great time. Oneg is, I sit down with a group of people and my soul feels settled. It's like when I go home now every other year on Thanksgiving with my family, I see them a little bit more than that, but that's good. And all of a sudden maybe my family's lucky in this way, with my siblings, and there's a certain calm that comes over my body, and the adrenaline that pushes me through most of my days goes away, and I just feel a comfort that I don't know how to explain. Like God just sort of slams down into that place, and I'm thinking, this is Oneg. This is religious delight. I'm not giddy. I'm just content. So that's why I think the Shabbat dinner table is one of the most important institutions in halachic Jewish life as a positive commandment, even though most religious Jews tend to focus on the Isurim, the other side. But I just want to show you that it's real. Here's the Sefer HaManhig. V'chen katav Rav Natronai. So here's what Rav Natronai the Gaon wrote. V'yom tov harishon shal Rosh Hashanah im l'itanot min HaTorah. You can't fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Min HaTorah. Oh, sorry. It's the flip two full pages, and it's the half page with Hebrew only on it, and it's the second source on the page. Also did a great job. Number of sources.
You said the second.
Yes.
With only you got it.
Yeah. Now, so Rav Achronai says on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, from the Torah, you can't fast. Why? Because if you fast, you can't possibly experience Oneg, or in this case, Yantif, including Simcha. Aval, v'yom sheni v'shabbat yachol hitanot. But according to Rav Achronai, on yom sheni shel Rosh Hashanah, because we know it's like all of the other Yantifs, even though in Israel it's celebrated 2 days as well, but technically we have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah for exactly the same reasons we have 2 days of Rosh Chodesh. And on Shabbat, you can fast. And here's what the Sefer HaMadhig says, v'ein nireli. No. You can't fast on, and he's going to say on Shabbat. He who soter devarav. He's going to create a conflict with what he's saying. Shegam ha-Shabbat min ha-Torah. Yikatav ve-karata le-Shabbat onik. There's a positive, just like there's a positive commandment from the Torah to experience joy on Yontif, there's a positive commandment from the Torah to experience joy. And so you cannot fast, because part of feeling joyful is not having an empty stomach all of the time. The chamur meyonto legave ochel nefesh. And that's, oneg is even more strict. We ought to be strict about this positive commandment. Even more so than on Yontif. And also Yom Tov Sheni, don't sort of separate Yom Tov Sheni out from Yom Tov Rishon. We actually treat them both exactly the same halakhically. One is not lesser than the other, with the exception, I think, of maybe funerals, because both days are a safek. I mean, even though we know both days aren't a safek scientifically, both days are technically a safek, and so there's really no difference between the two when it comes to observing them in diaspora. So what? Oneg is an obligation. Goes even further. Look at the Rambam, and here's why I think the category of Oneg is 100% subjective. Look at the second source in the box there on the Rambam. Shani Shvali Tanot v'Shabbat v'Yom Tov Chayav in a Torah. Somebody who fasts on Shabbat or Yom Tov is obligated. They're going to make a Shvuat Shav. They're going to make an oath in vain, and so they would get Torah lashes. Torah lashes are worse than rabbinic lashes. It's a whole other story, but it's meant to say, this is serious. Mishum shehishvua shav shaharei nishvav lebatel hamitzvah. Because you can't make an oath to get rid of a mitzvah, an obligation, from your life. Now, it doesn't say, but it's just oneg and it's subjective. It's a mitzvah. It's an obligation. Hands down. One more source from the Shulchan Aruch. Now I'm going ahead of even where our tshuva is, but I picked this source because it was clear. Sa'if Bet of the Shulchan Aruch, Siman, Resh Pei Chet, Yesh Omrim Shadam Shemezik La'achila, Da'az Oneg U'shalo Le'achol. There are people for whom eating certain things would actually hurt them, or eating anything. They're sick, whatever it is. You can't eat in that moment. And I'm thinking, if Oneg's a mitzvah about eating, but eating makes me feel crappy, do I still have to? Is oneg so objective that I have to do that one act? Does one act define the obligation? And the answer is lo. You should not eat. Also, people who cry. Right? Oneg isn't about laughter and joy necessarily, though it can be. Some people feel deep, soulful contentment when they let tears out in times that they normally wouldn't. And he says, Lechatzar Milibo. Contentment, this religious contentment, comes from letting pain out of the heart. Sometimes halakhic language is profound and deep and spot on to the human emotion. We just sort of push those sources aside a lot. Mutar. It's permitted. Oneg is entirely subjective. Entirely subjective doesn't mean necessarily I can explicitly break diorita isurim. I love driving fast. I love racing cars on Shabbat. It gives me so much joy.
Right? So there are, of course, within a halakhic community, people are going to come up with limits to its trumping power. But within the realm of halakha, if we want to start legislating against the kinds of things people are doing to feel religious contentment, when they're not explicitly breaking Isurei Diraita, that's what some of these texts are hinting at. Now, let's go back and look at the answer of the Trumat Hadeshin, which I think is as simple as it needs to be and quite remarkable. So, second side.
First page, second side.
Here's his answer to the question of people who gather on Shabbat to talk politics. Yira, he almost always, begins his tshuvot with, it seems. It's a sign of humility.
When you said people gather to talk about politics, do you mean that it's like epic Kiddush, or is it specifically?
Probably playing Shesh Beish in the park or something like that.
But is the meeting specifically like, we are going to meet about politics, or it just organically comes?
Imagine that you have a group of friends, and when the six of you get together, the conversation is always going to end up there. And I think because they're living in 15th century Austria, it's going to be intense. People's lives are at stake on the one hand, I'm thinking he means those conversations that get your adrenaline going, and maybe even sometimes you regret saying something you said in one of those moments, but it could lead to that. But it seems outside it. It's not, we're just going to sit and talk Parsha, which I think is an instinct on Shabbat, or at least what we think an instinct ought to be. So his answer is Yireh. V'tzarich v'datei midbar. I need to, investigate a little bit. V'tosafot v'chena ashiri katvu. The parak Elushar. The Tosafot wrote on the passage of Gemara that we learned, that asur l'harbot v'sicha v'tela v'shabbat v'nuchach v'uvda v'ema d'rashi. That it's forbidden to increase our speech that isn't directly related to what's happening in the Shabbat moment that you're in, as proved when Rashbi said to his mother, it's Shabbos, and she stopped talking. Just as we learned before in the Tosafot. We learn from this text, and this is still in the Tosafot, that we don't talk on Shabbat like we do during the week. This is the end of the Tosafot. We learn from the Yerushalmi that they had a hard time even permitting somebody to greet somebody else if it wasn't directly related to a Shabbat activity. So from this Tosafot, what we learn is that it's clearly forbidden to increase speech on Shabbat, and certainly you can't speak more on Shabbat than you do during the week. So that's significant here, because in a work week, in which you're busy all the time and you're working and you don't have time to sit down with friends and talk, so it may be that Shabbat is the only time in which you're able to gather with the friends who are dearest to you or the friends that you want to have these conversations with. And so looking at this already from the Tosafot's perspective and saying, like, on Shabbat we're really not supposed to talk that much outside of the immediate context of what's happening in the space of Shabbat. And certainly you can't do that more than the week. But that creates a direct conflict for the question being asked to him, which is clearly a group of people who can't do this on Tuesday night because they worked all day and they're taking care of their families or whatever is happening in their world. Now here's the true motivation for you. But if this group of people feels oneg in this activity, shemidabrim misaprim shmuot, they talk about current events, politics, war, life, death. As many people do, in order to sort of, feel that desire to talk about real things with people, things that are actually happening in the world, it seems this is absolutely permitted. Now, he gives us almost always the Trimunta Desha will give you the ruling before he justifies his ruling. He'll tell you why it's not. He will say, without saying these words, here's why most people don't think what I'm about to permit is permitted. Let me first tell you, it's permitted. He sort of lays it down always first, almost always first. You should understand this. Kids love running and jumping on Shabbat. And they also love going out and looking at things and seeing the world. Now, running and jumping on Shabbat is forbidden. Why? We're not supposed to walk on Shabbat like we do during the week. That means running and jumping. Shabbat, actually, based on the verses in Isaiah, where God says, if you find a way to do things differently, I'll sort of let you go across the world and see it at a different pace. I think the rabbis really understood that if you change the pace of your life on Shabbat, and this is, I believe, a deep truth, it will change the way in which you experience the world. Think about how fast we're walking all of the time. So when the rabbi said you're walking on Shabbat, should not be by the way, you're walking during the day, and I think they really may have meant the pace of your walking, not because the act technically is different, but because what you experience when you change the action can transform the way in which you perceive the world and see people in that moment. But the Sefer Mitzvot Katan, in talking about this halakha, was asked about what about kids who love playing? Have you ever watched a kid running and jumping through the world? You want to explain to me Oneg in a different way than that? And he says, of course they can run and jump. Now, and it's not just because, by the way, they're kids and it doesn't matter because they're not, you know, at the age of chiyuv. He means, subjectively, people experience Oneg in different ways. Hachazina, paragraph 3. Even though the Gemara itself says you're walking on Shabbat should not be like you're walking on the weekday, that means running and jumping. Even though the Gemara is explicit about the prohibition, if somebody is doing this from a sense of delight, mutar. It's permitted. Hu hadin v'im yatzi chayetera. This also has to be the ruling for extra speech. D'nafkala nami mahati kramim tzochav tzecha v'daber davar. We learn this whole set of laws from the same verses. Kamosha pershua tosvot v'ashiri v'ahayim. Flip the page. Which is to say, even though you're not allowed to speak more on Shabbat than you do during the weekday, it's not the quantity of the speech that the Gemara really means to talk about, or the Tosafot, exactly as you said, Alex. It's the quality of the speech and the emotional contentment that the speech may give you. So that means the answer to the question is, may we gather to talk politics on Shabbat? Is potentially, yeah. Potentially, yeah, because I think this is what I think of my grandmother, my nani, her memory, a significant blessing in my life. She was a master mahjong player. And so I used to go, when she was alive, I would sometimes go as a grandkid. And I did this up until I was probably 20, 23 years old, maybe even more. I would just go sit there with all her friends. I loved it. We would go visit in Boca Raton. Mm-hmm. We moved to Boca Raton eventually, so it was easier. And she'd be sitting around the table with her friends, and they would be yelling at each other while they were playing. Yelling about politics. It was generally, you know, three Democrats and one Republican.
He's letting Sibylle on.
So, and I used to like see the adrenaline going, and they would say things to each other, and I couldn't believe it. And man, it's only, I think, when that game died that she started to. That was her oneg. Her delight was sitting around the table with her closest friends and arguing. Deep joy she found in that. It kept her alive longer than her body should have. And so, what the Truman Nadeshnik is saying is, how can I be the one to tell any individual what will give their person, their life, that sense of wonder, that sense of joy? And now he says the other side, because I think the other side is just as important. Om nam ra'iti harbet pa'amim shamik sa'me otam b'nei adam ha'mitaf sim l'saper shmot halalu. There are times, on the other hand, when people gather together, and actually don't enjoy the conversations they're having about the politics. And what he says here is kind of interesting in his language. They just sort of walk into the conversation, and this conversation about politics, and this happens to each one of us, I promise. And you know they're talking about politics, and you're thinking, I don't want to get into that conversation. I don't want to get into that conversation. I know my adrenaline's going to go, and I can hear what's saying. I'm going to say something to somebody that I'm going to regret. And they say, no, what do you think? And then you step right in, and you're right in the middle of the conversation, and you walk out of that conversation, and you say, I wish I would not have been there in that moment. That is not oneg.
For that person, it's asur, basically.
For that person, it's asur. Because it's not the objective meaning of the words that determine oneg. It's the subjective feeling that they give each person who is a part of the conversation. And what I love most about this tshuva and how it ends, for him he says, who is the posek? This is, by the way, this is why it's intuition, subjectivity, and personal autonomy. Who's the posek?
You.
This we've taken away from our people when it comes to the, I think the positives, I say we've taken it like everybody takes away from their people, but I think the system, especially over the past few hundred years, has taken this away from our people. Each person determines the emotional feeling of their religiosity. Nobody can do that for them. You can only give people the tools, the opportunities with which they can feel that depth. In this case, on Shabbat, when it comes to observing the mitzvah, the positive commandment from the Torah, or the prophets, but is lifted up to Torah, at least according to the Manhig, it's up to the individual posek who happens to be the individual person who is about to experience something powerful or degrading. And sometimes you just choose. You choose in that moment. I'm in the middle of a conversation I don't want to be a part of. Everybody seems to be enjoying themselves, but I'm actually feeling kind of bad about the things that are being said. You could say, stop. I mean, this isn't about the obligation to stop other people from saying horrible things, though that could be a different shiur. This is, remove yourself. Because if you start talking, it will be sicha yetera. You will be increasing speech on Shabbat. I feel that this is a powerful model for what halakha could look like in many of the communities in which we're talking to people about how to create religious life for themselves in their home. And I feel like we so often say there's you know, observant religious Judaism, and then there's spirituality or feeling something bigger than yourself. And I don't think every religious experience fits into categories of halakha, but halakha is more expansive than I think we often talk about, and oneg, and what we're going to see in a moment, simcha. These are powerful legal categories that trump even negative commandments. And so when I want people to experience Shabbat, and I start them on oneg, I am not making a compromise. I'm not making a halakha compromise. And I won't ever be apologetic or pretend that I am. I am holding up what I think is one of the most important mitzvot of the Torah, Oneg, on Shabbat. Because the reverberations of an emotional, real Oneg experience are quite lasting. And that means sometimes that I'll have people do something that is Asur D'Rabbanan, Chas V'Shalom, for the sake of Oneg Shabbat, based on their personal subjective understanding. So I was once asked when I was teaching the shiur, I love reading those Lashon Hara magazines. This was the language given to me. Lashon Hara magazines. I really just love that. Can I do that on Shabbat? Now, nothing in life is simple. Everything in halakha is complicated. So there are all sorts of things happening when you pick up certain materials, because reading it in itself gives people deep pleasure. And so really, is it so subjective that anything goes? I don't think that necessarily. I think there are always going to be boundaries. And what I want to explain to people often is, I want you to separate out things that make you feel good from things that give you soulful contentment. And I think if you ask the right questions to anybody who's saying, who's asking you, am I permitted to do this thing that I like doing on Shabbat? If you have the right questions at hand, you can help them understand what that means. And people can make their own decisions. Not about how to define the categories, but how to experience and feel the categories. And I think we need to give our people that kind of ownership. I really do.
When you say to be over on a de Rabbanan, what are you?
Like a psikresha? Let me give an example. If somebody thought that flipping on a light was an isur diaraita, but doing it with your elbow would be ground, it would be indirect, and some kind of psikresha or malacha sheina tzricha legufa, then I would, and they said, and I walk, you know, I walk into the room and the light is off, and I just want to sit down and read this book I've been reading because this is the author that sort of really sings to my soul with the poetry. I would say flip. I'd say turn on that light. I wouldn't hesitate for a moment. And I'm not going to be apologetic and say, well, you shouldn't really, you should go find another place, but what if there isn't another place? Well, then you'll just read it. This is my favorite answer. Read it on Sunday. No. Shabbat's the space, the religious space, to create that avirah, that atmosphere. And so, is there a slippery slope somewhere along the line? Yes. Is there a risk? Yes. Is it a risk worth taking? I think so. Absolutely. Absolutely. And there, I can give you a whole host of examples.
I think in my case, I have congregants who try and keep a great semblance of Shabbat. They do weird things like they'll cook, but they won't let their kids watch TV. It's weird. And I have conversations, you know, it's and they're miserable. And their kids are, you know, I know we think TV is evil, but rabbis, a lot. That's what I hear.
Oh, on Shabbat or in general?
No, just in general and on Shabbat. But I said, you know, it's much worse to cook, I think, than it is to watch television. And I'm wondering if, like, you give an example, hard example of, like, reading a book, but I'm looking for something more. You know, like, this is the reality that...
I'm totally with you. Yeah, I think the content...
Why don't you watch TV? If you're miserable not watching TV, but how can you do it in a soulful... I like that soulful...
I think picking a battle about TV with when there's cooking, let's say, it's so antithetical. I think that's a moment in which we can actually help people understand what it means to have sort of that emotional, joyful feeling on a particular day. And so it's a chance to talk about content, because everybody knows that when they watch reality TV, they might laugh and feel good and it could be funny and your adrenaline is going, but nobody feels good about the way in which people are treated on those shows. People do feel good.
I just think that what you're saying is a power, if we could be open and honest with our people, which I think we should be regarding this, I think it would be a powerful.
You watch TV on Shabbat, so let's talk about what that could create. Now, that won't work for everybody, and some people, let's say, are glued to TV all week long, and so it's not always just one thing pitted against the other. Sometimes it's really complicated, and so I uvdin d'chol is a real halakhic category, and I believe deeply in it, but some people don't. I have people ask me this all. Are people out in the world that ask through their rabbis, I don't watch TV. I never watch TV. I never get to watch. I work.
Right.
I work 20-hour days. And so sometimes it's Saturday, because on Sunday I'm working again, or my kids are doing this, that, and the other. I got birthday parties. So.
Right. That's the example.
I just wanted to ask, start with a simple question, which is, because I get asked this question all the time, which is talked about, but things that are clearly a sore, you know, what I really, what really makes the rest and the joy of Shabbat is, you know, writing poetry or, you know, whatever it is. And how do you, I mean, just practically, what do you say?
Yeah.
In that case.
I think that's a really good example because some people, it isn't until if they're poets or artists, actually gardening and art are the two things I get asked about the most. So it's you can't actually get more explicitly. I mean gardening, right? You can't really, or for art, the creation of art to a certain extent, depending on the materials that are being used. And I just want to say flat out, I don't want to misread this text. He's not saying Oneg will trump anything else. Although there are sources in the Gemara that say when there's a positive commandment and a negative commandment, you always choose the positive commandment. It's only if there's a positive commandment and two negative commandments that the negatives win. Most people forget that. So I think one could make a halakha claim, but I'm not sure that it's helpful. So I have decided from now on to be transparent with people. Just to be transparent and recognize that we live in a world in which not everybody's going to be in the system, that the majority of American Jews, let's say, will never be in this, like, they're not going to be from. I think it's okay for us to now accept that we will never achieve whatever dream was 80 years ago. It's not going to happen in this country. And guess what? It's okay because there's still space for deep religiosity within a rabbinic framework. So I tend to now just be honest with people. There's no way that the system, as I understand it, would justify that. So if that's a choice that you're making, that traditional rabbinic Judaism doesn't even know what to do with. They don't even know what to do with it. If that's where your deepest sense of contentment comes from, I'm not going to tell you not to do it. And if Shabbat really is the only time that you can do it, then you make those choices. I just will never. That's at a certain point. I will not work the system. I think that does damage to the system. I'd rather just say that it's outside of the system. And so you can still. It doesn't mean you can't experience Oneg when you're breaking laws. I mean, clearly he's saying on a certain level you can't do that. But I don't want to say the system justifies it. And so I will try to talk with people about Malachat Machshavet and finding the space to pull back from the things that sustain us during the week. But I have to be honest, I don't have a great answer for somebody who says my passion can only be performed one day of the week and it brings me deep, profound joy. I will not judge that person, and if they decide that Shabbat is the space in which they can find joy, and they actually think it's religious, believe, and I'm not saying they think it, it's not, I'm saying that is for them a sense of religious joy, so it breaks our tradition, and guess what? That happens in the world, and it happened, and it's always happened, and I just don't want to judge them, and what I do communally might be different for the individual. But I don't want people to feel bad. I want to explain to them what the system says. I want to explain to them that there may be room already in the system for you to experience that in a different way. There are other options. But at the end of the day, that's the choice to make. I wouldn't write a tshuva.
Because it gets the tendency of rabbis to always assume that people can't make those choices themselves. I mean, the whole issue of the driving tshuva, which drives people nuts, you know, it's the fact that, you know, that we said, you know, that people were doing it anyway, and so we allowed them to do it, and some people took it, you know, and took it they could drive anywhere, other people take it very seriously. And then they turn around and they take the other side of it, you know, the teshuva on electronics on Shabbat, or something as simple as a Kindle, and because it's possible that maybe you'll purchase something, it's a store. There's no sense at all that people can make these kinds of decisions, or we don't even give them the right to make the decisions.
Well, that right. By the way, in those law committee meetings, the best argument against that was, do we go into people's kitchens and tell them they can't have milk and meat in there just because they may eat them together? Right? Like, there are so many things, there are things which we put into the hands of people and say, you know what problems, you know what could happen, But like, it's your thing.
Just so one clarification. Is that, was that the argument for the Kindle, or was
that's
it right?
That's what it says
in the show. Amy Levin. No, Amy Levin brought that up. It was quite brilliant.
I thought it was because it, when you, it's a, it records on a chip or something. That's
There are some memory issues that involve, but the memory issues are really not intent. Like,
so the bigger issue was the less
that's what it said. Size. Yeah. I know what it said.
But then you can't.
All right. So wait, I just want to walk down.
You can't walk down the street because you can walk.
Well, this is what's. If this is.
You say you'll pay them back.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things like the memory is an issue, by the way. But yeah, with the old school Kindle, memory is not the issue like it is with an iPad, and I think there's a difference between the two. But I think I'm supposed to stop it, and I just want you to see the first line of the second Shuba. I'm 5 minutes over already.
No.
And I think.
What is it?
It's 10:05. And there's a Knesset member speaking. And
there is a Knesset member speaking. She's in your. She's in your session.
It's only me, Elisa.
Yeah, you have a 15-minute cushion that you're working with. It's like 18 minutes. You have a cushion.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have this beard to hide how red my face is right now. Thank you for being here. Thank you for serving our people. Sorry, that was embarrassing. Okay. So remember, the question is, am I allowed to use this rabbinic device of an Eruv to go walk, to be outside in a garden on Yom. And that simcha, like if I just want to be outside, that's my space of joy, but it's a far walk, how far does the system go? And by the way, his answer is, Yered Deshari L'Arif Hagav. Yes, it is permitted to Holech B'Yom Tov B'Tayel Tiul. Is there anything different? The rabbis did have words for leisure, L'Tayel. It's the same thing that you are obligated to do in a sukkah. If you're having leisure time during Sukkot, you have an obligation to do it in the space of Sukkot. The Sukkah. L'tayel chashiv l'dvar mitzvah. Leisure time is considered a mitzvah if it brings you happiness. Now, I just want to... He's going to go on. I'm not going to go through the Tshuva because we don't have time. You can look at it and the translation is reasonable. He goes on to sort of explain to his detractors who would have said, no, you may not do this, what all of the proofs are for why you can. He doesn't even suggest for a moment that simcha isn't a real, operative, objective and subjective category of halakha. And guess what? It's not just about food. Although, in the Gemara, it seems to be about basar and yain, about meat and wine, but already the Gemara split the category. So I'll end here. First, I want to thank everybody for coming, but I also just want to give people the sort of chizuk to take positive, emotional, religious categories out into the world and not be afraid to say, this too is halacha. How you feel religiously is a legal category. It's halacha. It's how we walk through the world Jewishly, and sometimes it's going to be more important than the don'ts. Sometimes. And it's just that subjective, and it takes a little bit of intuition. And I think the posek's most important tool.